Well, thank you very much. I want to try to give a fairly general talk about material, matter, now universe, but with some emphasis on the more recent discoveries. You'll notice the talk is addressed to the interstellar medium. I shall omit almost completely stars. They are fairly obvious, obviously present, moderately well understood, although many of them are very poorly understood still, many types of stars. Between the stars, it's been known for a long time that there is a tenuous gas with a density about 1 per cubic centimeter, within an order of magnitude of that. And it was Eddington who first pointed out clearly that much of this gas would be ionized and at a very high temperature, even though the temperature of interstellar space might be considered to be low. It's a high temperature because it's ionized by the ultraviolet radiation from stars. And so we have some regions close enough to stars to be almost completely ionized. We can observe this ionization by the radio radiation from the electrons, or we can observe ionized atoms heavier than hydrogen in the optical regions of the spectra. And these have been studied for a long time. We know something of the chemical composition of the various atoms in interstellar space. In other regions, not so close to stars, the atoms are largely unionized. These atoms have been studied very extensively by the 21 centimeter radiation, so we have a rather good map of the position and distribution of hydrogen in our own galaxy, where we can trace out spiral arms that otherwise are rather invisible or indistinguishable from simply optical radiation. We can trace the spiral arms of our own galaxy as we look through its flat plane with radio telescopes. Now, this I might call the canonical interstellar matter, but there is a great deal more to the story. Of course, the starlight itself produces something between the stars. It is diluted by a factor of about 10 to the 14th on the average. That is, the intensity in interstellar space is less than the intensity at the surface of a star by 10 to the 14th. And using the Stefan Boltzmann law, one can say, well, the total energy is equivalent to 10 to the 14th to the 1/4 power of the temperature of the star. It corresponds to a temperature of about 3 degrees. The spectrum is quite different. It's largely ultraviolet, but the energy density is equivalent to about the black body energy of 3 degrees rather than, let's say, 10,000 degrees, which is the surface of the star, because of the great dilution. There is, in addition, cosmic rays. There are X-rays, gamma rays. I won't take time to discuss their origins and meanings. They are, in terms of total energy, they are fairly minor amounts of material. A very important radiation discovered quite recently is the isotropic microwave radiation. Now, this radiation is generally thought to be a remnant of a very early stage of the universe, sometimes called the Big Bang. And if we represent our universe this way, it is pervaded with microwave radiation, which has approximately a black body spectrum for a temperature of 2.7 degrees K. That is, if we draw the spectrum, it's a black body curve, Planck's radiation distribution, where this is the energy or intensity, and this is frequency, and the peak here falls around 2 or 3 millimeters wavelength. We know this curve fairly well, and this part of it, the lower frequencies, up to about here. From here on, we know very little about it, but it fits very beautifully, a black body curve on that part of the spectrum. And this curve can be explained very nicely as the relict radiation left over from the time when the universe was very hot and very small and the radiation decoupled from the rest of the matter. And simply as the universe expanded, the wavelengths expanded until now they peak at a few, around the 2 or 3 millimeters range. However, There have been many attempts to explain the radiation other ways because some people don't like to accept a unique point in the creation of the universe, rather like the steady state universe. So far, those explanations have not been successful. Furthermore, we don't know the high frequency side of that curve, and so we don't really know that it has the right shape for such an explanation. In fact, recent measurements above the atmosphere show a radiation between about 1 millimeter and 0.5 millimeter, radiation somewhere in here, with a total energy almost two orders of magnitude greater than the total energy of this black body curve. So here is some very high energy here. In addition, clearly does not fit on the black body curve and must have some other explanation. Now, both aspects of this radiation, the so-called black body curve and the submillimeter radiation, are isotropic, approaching us apparently equal intensity from all directions. This isotropic property allows us to get some idea of the Earth's velocity through space for the first time. If, for example, our Earth is here, moving in this direction, it sweeps up radiation more in that direction than if we were to look in this direction. If we point an antenna forward, we pick up more radiation than if we point an antenna backwards. So this allows us to make a direct measurement of the velocity of the Earth through the general field of the universe, or we might say with respect to the center of gravity of the rest of the universe. Strangely, such a measurement turns out to detect no motion. It's almost reminiscent of the Michelson-Morley experiment, but really quite different in that, of course, such a motion would not violate a special relativity. We know that the Earth is moving with respect to the center of our own galaxy by a few hundred kilometers per second, and yet the motion detected here is less than maybe 150 or 200 kilometers per second. And one might expect our own galaxy is moving through space somewhat faster than we're moving with respect to its center. It is a bit surprising, then, to find no detectable motion, although, of course, quite possible that we happen to be fairly stationary. Now, further than the radiation and the classical interstellar medium of tenuous gases, there are also cool clouds, and there is a type of instability which means that there's a tendency to form either very tenuous hot clouds heated up by the stellar radiation or condensations of cool clouds where there may be a good deal of dust. The first slide will show a picture of this dust. You can see that it's perfectly real. Generally, astronomers look at the bright objects in the sky mostly, and the dust is a kind of a nuisance in obscuring what one wants to look at. Here we have what's known as the Horsehead Nebula, a dark nebula lighted up by a brighter nebula from behind, and obviously obscuring some of the stars behind, and a much larger cloud down below. These dust particles we know something about. We know a little about their composition, but they're most frequently thought to be silicates or graphite. Silicate seems the more likely composition. Probably no very fixed composition. We know their sizes are about a tenth of a micron, generally. We can tell that from scattered radiation. And they also tend to be aligned a bit so that there is a polarization effect. We know a modest amount about these dust particles by looking at the effects on starlight. Now, such dust clouds are very common, in fact, and contain perhaps the bulk of the mass in our galaxy. The next slide shows a picture on a much smaller scale now of the Milky Way, where one can see all of the dark splotches in the center of the Milky Way. This happens to be the southern Milky Way. All of those dark splotches represent dark, cool dust clouds blotting out the starlight, and you see that it's scattered all through the plane of our galaxy, which is represented by the Milky Way. One reason that these clouds have not been much studied before is, of course, that they're not giving us any light to look at. They've been rather hard to study. light doesn't penetrate the clouds, but with recent developments in the infrared and in the microwave region, technical developments, it's now easy to penetrate the clouds and study them because these waves are long enough to not be scattered very much by the dust particles. And so we can look right into the depths of the clouds or through them and do spectroscopy to find out what is there. The next slide shows an absorption due to the molecule formaldehyde. Now the lower curve is formaldehyde with carbon 12, oxygen 16, the common isotopes. That is a plot of the absorption from the radiation coming from a highly ionized region of the type I spoke of originally that emits a continuum of radiation, of microwave radiation. That radiation passing through some cloud containing dust and obviously formaldehyde and being absorbed out at the formaldehyde resonance. The plot is in the vertical direction. The ordinates are what's known as antenna temperature, which represents simply an intensity picked up by an antenna. The abscissae represent radial velocities with respect to the Earth. Rather than frequencies, we've simply translated a frequency into a Doppler velocity. We know what the rest frequency of the formaldehyde is. And you will see from this then that there are clouds corresponding to a number of different velocities, the biggest one being at plus 50, that is moving towards us at 50 kilometers per second. A small one there at minus 50, moving away from us at 50 kilometers per second. In the upper slide, you will see immediately something that is of additional interest, namely the carbon 13 formaldehyde, which will give us some indication of the relative abundance of these two isotopes of carbon 12 and carbon 13. In the same regions of space and well outside our own solar system. Now, what can we deduce from such spectra? Of course, the fact that formaldehyde is there, and this was something of a surprise to many astronomers, because we're accustomed to the less tenuous gas in interstellar space where molecules are destroyed easily by ultraviolet radiation. In fact, the lifetime of such molecules in the normal interstellar radiation field of ultraviolet is only about 100 years. This is a very short on an astronomical scale, so one cannot expect the molecules to be present in any abundance. But the dust so shields the molecules that it's very easy inside of these dust clouds to get protection, enough protection to make the lifetime millions of years or greater. We don't know just what those lifetimes are because there are cosmic rays which penetrate the clouds. The clouds even screen out much of the cosmic radiation and X radiation, but there's some cosmic rays which penetrate. Furthermore, the gases freeze out on the dust particles and hence are captured that way in perhaps the order of a million years. So there is some slow attrition of the molecules and they must be recreated within the clouds in order to exist even there under those protected conditions for in any real abundance. But we know something about the abundance and amount from this spectra. We, of course, know the velocities of the clouds. We can study the isotopic, relative isotopic concentration and hence tell something about the processing which the matter has gone through within stars. Carbon-13 is particularly important because in the carbon, oxygen, nitrogen cycle to produce energy within stars. The carbon-13 would have a fairly definite abundance, if that cycle is dominant, of about one quarter the abundance of carbon-12. Now on Earth, that abundance ratio is about 1 to 90, and very different. Why we should have that particular ratio on Earth isn't understood. There seems to be nothing sacred about it. So one should expect substantial variations in these variations to tell us how the material has been processed, whether it's come from stars in the past or what kinds of stars. The general belief is that the dust, at least, has come probably from stellar atmospheres, essentially smoking stars, relatively cool stars, Possibly the molecules have come from stellar atmospheres also, but more likely the molecules are formed on the dust clouds. There is a cycle, however, in which these clouds then condense, recondense, produce new stars, which then further processes the material and later perhaps spews it out again into other clouds. So it's a study of that kind of cycle which the isotopic abundances should help us with. Next, the excitation and relaxation of the molecular states can be very enlightening, also very difficult to understand. The next slide shows the energy levels of this molecule formaldehyde, indicating the transitions which have so far been found. On the right-hand side, you will see the narrowest spacing is about 6 centimeter wavelength. Corresponds to the wavelength that I was just showing and the most common frequency for observing formaldehyde. But there is an excited rotational state above the next widest spacing of 2 centimeters, which is also observed, and even another one up above that, which is not indicated here, that has been observed. Then transitions on the right-hand side at about 2 millimeters. And on the left-hand side, another transition down about 2 millimeters or slightly below. Now, it would be natural to say that having measured the intensity of one or two of these lines, we can determine the temperature of the molecule. But the molecule is far from any temperature equilibrium. The processes of excitation and of relaxation are slow, of the same order of magnitude. For example, the molecule radiates in a time of a few years, perhaps, depending on which particular transition we're discussing. It radiates spontaneously in a time of a few years, and that is comparable with the time between collisions, which may excite the molecule. The molecule is also bathed in the radiation fields we've discussed, in particular the microwave field. This isotropic microwave radiation, which forces transitions, and so there is a competition between these mechanisms and some others to excite the molecule and determine how many molecules there are in each level. So a detailed understanding of that can tell us something about the frequency of molecular collision and the intensity of the isotropic radiation, particularly, hopefully, on the high-frequency side where we so far have little information. Now, you will notice, too, that these levels have been broken into two parts. On the left-hand side, we have levels with the first subscript even. On the right-hand side, the levels with the first subscript odd. This corresponds exactly to the ortho and para states of hydrogen. Formaldehyde has such a symmetry that the two hydrogens are equivalent. And on the right-hand side, we have ortho formaldehyde. On the left-hand side, para formaldehyde. And these two systems do not interchange very easily, just as ortho and para hydrogen are almost separate gases. They can interchange, be converted one to the other, only under special conditions. And hence the equilibrium and relative abundance of these two species tells us something else still. The processes which bring them in equilibrium have to do probably with exchange with hydrogen atoms or with surface adsorption of the molecules and transitions on the surface between those two. Already then, there is quite a wealth of information possible here if we can properly unravel it. The next slide shows also the wealth of molecules that have been recently discovered with the year of their discovery. On the left, just to show you that most of these are quite recent, and towards the right-hand side, we have whether they've been seen in emission or absorption. You see some are in absorption, many are in emission. And we have many different resonances. The frequencies are given over about the middle of the slide. Typically, they're rotational transitions. Sometimes they're hindered motions. Now, this is one list of molecules, and there's, you see, the OH radical, ammonia, water, formaldehyde. The next slide continues the list. This list is growing very rapidly, about a new molecule every month now. And here are additional molecules. Carbon monoxide, which is exceedingly abundant, perhaps the most abundant species of all other than the hydrogen molecule, which we'll come to. CN, hydrogen cyanide. The quantity called exergen there is an unknown molecule. The resonance has been found. Doesn't correspond to anything we know in the laboratory, and presumably is some ephemeric species. Then there is methyl alcohol. There is one particular spot in our universe in the Orion Nebula, which seems to be producing alcohol at a very rapid rate, but probably is not intelligent life because it's the wrong kind of alcohol. Then there is CS, silicon monoxide. Then there's methyl acetylene, and so on. These are fairly complex molecules, and there's another unknown down there. Now I should add cyanamide, which has recently been found, and let's see, formic acid should be in there somewhere. I don't see it at the moment. Formic acid has been found, and a dimethyl formaldehyde. So the list is growing quite rapidly, and you see there are many complex molecules, common molecules, many of them that we know in the laboratory, but we have not known before in space. And we have a whole chemistry there, still relatively little understood. We can see that the most abundant molecules are frequently the more stable molecules, but that's not always, there's not a strict correlation between stability and abundance. The next slide shows where these molecular species exist. A black dot is placed wherever a molecule has been found. That is, directions in which a molecule has been found. We've plotted here right ascension and declination, astronomical coordinates. The U-shaped curve corresponds essentially to our Milky Way. That is the plane of our galaxy. It doesn't look like a plane on this scale because of the plot. But that represents the intersection of the plane of our galaxy with the astronomical coordinates, right ascension and declination. And you'll see that the molecules are concentrated in the plane of the Milky Way, where all of those dust clouds are and where most of the other matter is. There's some molecules scattered off at various angles that are probably nearer by to us. And there's no special region of the universe, of our galaxy at least, that is favored over others. I said the universe because partly thinking that there is at least one case in which a molecule has been found in an external galaxy. OH has been found in two external galaxies, and so now we can begin to study the presence of molecules and their manufacture in other kinds of galaxies, some of quite different type from our own. Now, you'll notice we have not mentioned hydrogen molecules. Hydrogen atoms are well known from the 21 centimeter line. Hydrogen molecules have been very elusive, and yet hydrogen is the most abundant material in our universe. Hydrogen molecules are elusive because their spectra are difficult to detect. They have no dipole moment. Recently, satellite work has allowed the detection of some molecular hydrogen through ultraviolet spectroscopy. But I think perhaps our best way of locating the molecular hydrogen is an indirect argument, which is simply the molecular excitation itself. If there were not collisions, the molecules would all come into equilibrium with the 3-degree, or 2.7 degrees, I said more precisely, with this 2.7 degree isotropic microwave radiation. If they are in temperature equilibrium with that radiation, we would never see them in emission, because their emission would be at the same temperature, we would simply see that same black body radiation. So that if we see them at all, they must be disturbed by collisions or something, collisions being the only reasonable solution, and we can tell then something about the rate of disturbance by knowing the rate of spontaneous or stimulated emission due to the microwave radiation. The next slide shows the density. Oh, sorry. I seem to be a little out of order. So let me discuss this slide next, and then we'll come to the question of the density of hydrogen molecules. This slide is a composite to show the spectra of a number of different molecules in the same direction, and hence presumably in the same clouds or at least some of them may be in the same clouds. Now, we plot on the abscissa the Doppler velocity, and you will see that the various molecules largely have the same Doppler velocity, which is a clue to what might be guessed that they are in the same clouds. The lowest resonance curve is a resonance of the recombination state of hydrogen, that is a high electronic state, a high N value of around 108, 109, of the kind of levels that Professor Lamb has just talked about. And you see that is associated with ionized hydrogen, which captures an electron and then radiates microwave radiation. It's clear that those atoms are not at the same velocity as the molecules and are in a different place. They're in a region which is ionized. It's the same direction in space. They're in an ionized region, whereas the molecules are mostly at the same velocity and presumably in one of these dust clouds. This particular direction is the direction of Orion, the famous Orion nebula, but we now have evidence that most of the molecules are behind the visible Orion nebula rather than in front of it. We know that from the nature of the absorption and emission. The next slide will show a similar composite series of spectra from the center of our galaxy in the direction of Sagittarius. The first, the top curves are the resonances of OH. The next one is ammonia. And we come to formaldehyde. And you will see that there is fairly detailed correspondence between the shapes of these curves, for which we have some considerable intensity at least, for example, between the OH and the formaldehyde, but also some conspicuous differences. Then we come to the isotope of formaldehyde and an unknown molecule that we're calling exogen for the moment, hydrogen cyanide, and so on down. The methyl alcohol is the next to the bottom one, and you see it has essentially the same velocity. The bottommost curve represents the 21-centimeter absorption of atomic hydrogen. And again, one can see that the atomic hydrogen does not have the same velocity, and hence is not distributed the same as are the molecules. In fact, the amount of atomic hydrogen at the position or at the velocities where there are molecules is remarkably small. And yet, hydrogen is by far more abundant than any of the carbon or oxygen which make up the molecules. And this is a clue that the hydrogen is, in fact, in molecular form. The next slide now will show the density of hydrogen molecules which must be present in order to give the excitation which is seen. When we see HCN, which is the bottommost molecule in the table, we know that the density of hydrogen must be close to 6 times 10 to the 5th per cubic centimeter, or a particular resonance of formaldehyde will tell us that the density is as high at least as 10 to the 6th per cubic centimeter of hydrogen molecules, because those are required in order to maintain the excitation. Now, this is very different, you see, from the normal interstellar space with densities of about unity. These are very dense clouds, in fact, so dense that they will gravitationally collapse after a relatively short time, like thousands or millions of years, depending on the details of the density. And from these clouds, then, new stars condense out. The gravitational collapse can presumably produce new stars, and this is the origin of additional stars from material which perhaps came originally from an earlier generation of stars. Now, the next slide shows the energies of various bonds and the energy required to disrupt those bonds. The cartouche around each molecule will indicate the molecules which have so far been found. And you see that a good fraction of these molecules have been found, but there are some common ones like NO, which has fairly high binding, it hasn't yet been found. Oxygen, nitrogen are difficult to find, or acetylene over on the right, because they have no dipole moments. But most molecules then represent types which are sufficiently tightly bound that we can expect to see them, and we must believe then that a very wide variety of molecules are present. except for some special chemical conditions which perhaps destroy particular species. Now, I have mentioned the problem of excitation and how these molecules are far from thermal equilibrium. There are even heat engines in space which can produce things either refrigerated or continuously producing power as a result of this lack of equilibrium. In some regions of space, for example, the formaldehyde is cooled down to about 8-tenths of a degree absolute as a result of heat engines putting energy in and taking energy out by excitation, relaxation processes. In other regions of space, water and OH are heated up to what are sometimes called negative temperatures, but which in fact represent very high excitations, so that the energy levels, population of the energy levels are inverted. We have more molecules in an upper state than in a lower state, and the whole system can amplify like a maser. The next slide shows the location, a typical location of such masers. This is a source known as W3. It's a nebulosity in our galaxy. The dark areas here, this is a negative, so the dark areas represent really radiating areas. The dark areas are bright nebula, represents a bright nebula. The light region through the middle of that is a dust lane. That's a dust cloud in front of the bright nebula, which you see has fairly sharp edges. This is a bright nebula with dust clouds mixed with it. And down at the edge here, about where that arrow shows, is the region where we find these enormous amplifiers, which amplify microwave radiation and provide us with the most powerful known radio broadcast stations, broadcasting, in fact, a total energy in a radio region sometimes as large as the total luminosity of the sun. That is, all the radiation energy of the sun condensed into a single radio frequency line as a result simply of molecular amplification, or what might be called maser action, naturally occurring maser action. The next slide shows some radiation from water and different types of sources, which are clearly amplifying radiation this way. First, there is Orion, which is a top slide. You see a variety of velocities. There are many different clouds there which are radiating, amplifying and radiating. The next over here, in the middle on the left, is VY Canis Majoris, which is a variable star. It too radiates. In the middle on the right and on the bottom on the right are two different spots in this nebulosity which I've just shown you. So this represents, shows you some of the variety. The intensities are very large. The antenna temperatures here,
or the size of the signal, are perhaps 1,000 times greater than the signals which I've shown on other slides. Very powerful and very easy to detect now that we know that it's there.
The next slide shows a variation of such radiation with time. Here is another source known as W49, is just the number assigned to this source. It's a fairly powerful source, about 40,000 light years from us. So these represent masers which existed at least 40,000 years ago, long before on Earth. And you see that they're varying with time from month to month. Each one of these curves represents a gap of about 1 month. The spectrum, intensity, and the frequencies emitted are quite variable with time. That time variation itself tells us that the object radiating cannot be very large. Causality would indicate, although not completely rigorously, but at least reasonably indicates, that the size of the object cannot be greater than the velocity of light times the time required for variation. And that means these objects must not be bigger than a few light days in size. Whereas the dust clouds I've been talking about so far may be light years in size, and typically are. These objects can't be more than light days in size. And in fact, with a very long baseline interferometer, using two antennas across the continent of the United States,
one can show that the objects are exceedingly small, smaller in angular size than 1/2 × 10⁻⁸ radians. That means smaller in linear size and about the orbit of the Earth. The next slide shows a distribution of different radiating molecular clouds in the same source W49, each point representing a different spot from which radiation is emitted, and each point also represents a different frequency. So these are all individual clouds with their own velocities with respect to the Earth. The bars are simply the uncertainty in position. They don't represent the size, but the uncertainty in position with respect to the central dot there in the middle. No one of these has been resolved with an interferometer stretching from the eastern part of the United States to the western part of the United States and some few hundred million wavelengths long, so that each one of these is less than the limit that I mentioned, and hence are of the dimensions of a large star or a planetary system. One can show also that these sources must be rather dense, still denser than our dark clouds, with densities of about 10 to the 10th or 10 to the 12th particles per cubic centimeter. So the total mass involved, knowing the size and the density, we can get the mass. The mass is comparable with stellar masses or planetary masses. And I think one can make a very reasonable case that these represent regions where new stars are forming. Some of these objects radiating so intensely may be protostars themselves. Some of them may be wisps of clouds left over after the cloud collapses into a star, leaving parts of it here and there nearby, which are also rather dense, perhaps corresponding to the comets which occasionally approach our sun, but are normally some distance from the sun and may be left over from the original formation of our solar system. Now, they have high velocities, velocities which are large enough that should allow us to trace the relative motion of these individual clouds with respect to each other over a period of a few years, so that we presumably will then learn a little bit about the dynamics of these objects as well. Well, now, let me get back to our isotropic radiation again. There is a very important puzzle about this isotropic radiation. On the one hand, it's our best clue, in fact, perhaps a proof, that our universe does have a history of going through a very hot period where it was very hot in a very small radius and then expanding. And yet, about half of the spectrum of that radiation, we really don't know very well. An examination of the excitation of some of these molecules has already given us a bit more information about the high frequency side of the curve, telling us that within a factor of 4 or 5, anyhow, the black body curve is satisfactory. But that's not good enough. And I think that further microwave resonances coupled with infrared resonances and the use of these molecules as probes should give us a pretty clear picture of the higher frequency part of that curve, down to perhaps about 1 millimeter or maybe slightly less. The radiation below 1 millimeter is also very important, but still much more of a puzzle. We have no idea where that can come from. The total amount of energy, if it is indeed isotropic and hence fills all of our universe, the total amount of energy is about as large as all of the energy that could have come from the conversion of all of the hydrogen in the universe to the present amount of helium that we see. All of that energy would be necessary in order to give us this high-intensity radiation just below 1 millimeter. That seems like a very costly way to produce such radiation, because that energy is needed for a variety of other things, and furthermore, how it could have been converted into a particular frequency range is quite puzzling. In the isotopic constitution
of our nearby universe, that is our own galaxy. We don't yet have a very clear picture, but those cases where we can be relatively sure that the isotopic ratios are correctly measured all give us values very close to the carbon-12, carbon-13 ratio found on Earth. Now, I'll remind you again that that ratio is about 90 to 1. In the normal production of stellar energy coming to equilibrium, we should expect about 4 to 1. If that process doesn't occur, but other established mechanisms for production of energy in stars do occur, then we should have a ratio of about infinity. And so this particular number that we find on Earth is puzzling. Why it should be anything like universal is doubly puzzling. It may be that we've been able to measure the ratio well only within the immediate vicinity of our own solar system, which happens to be more or less uniform. As we look deeper into our galaxy, the ratios become somewhat less, that is, closer to 4 to 1, but in those cases, the opacity of the clouds that we've so far studied and the ways in which they've been studied do not allow us to get any very accurate picture. And while we have ratios of intensities of lines about 4 to 1, it's clear that those lines are saturated optically and that the actual ratio is substantially higher. What value it has, we don't yet know. Oddly enough, also, the isotopic ratio of oxygen 18 to oxygen 16, insofar as it's been measured in interstellar space, is very close to that found on Earth. And there is some indication that the isotopic abundance of nitrogen 15 compared to nitrogen 14 is also. Finally, let me make a comment on the biological side. There's been speculation from time to time and newspaper stories about what this plethora of molecules means to biology and the origins of life. Does this show us, for example, that because organic molecules can be formed in interstellar space, and in fact fairly complex organic molecules, just those molecules that the biochemists have suggested are responsible for the origin of life, does this show us that life is common in other regions, or that life is easy to form? It is certainly true that it's just these series of molecules, such as ammonia, HCN, formaldehyde, HNCO, which the biochemists have used as a starting point, and from which one can synthesize fairly natural processes, amino acids, and it may well be we'll find amino acids here too. In fact, I think it's almost certain that the molecules of that complexity and more will be found in time. Amino acids can be synthesized, and it's known, for example, that ammonia and HCN and water heated together with silicates will produce polypeptides, which in a sense are primitive proteins. Now, what does it mean to biology? Such clouds may well have been the origin of our planets as they condensed. It may well be that our planets did not heat up as they consolidated from these dust clouds, and so some of these molecules formed in interstellar space could have been then the starting material in the beginning atmospheres from which life developed. On the other hand, if the solar system heated up, these molecules were probably destroyed. If our planet had been heated up, molecules were probably destroyed and had to reform. I don't see that that's terribly important. It seems to me, however, the one thing that this molecular evidence says about the biological problem is that it's easy for natural processes to form these molecules, and probably a variety of natural processes can form them. There's no reason they could not have been formed then on the surface of the Earth. We know now with recent experimentation that adsorbed simple gases adsorbed on surfaces and treated with ultraviolet can produce some of the more complex gases that we see here. So we do know that these starting points at least can commonly be formed by normal physical processes, as they're obviously being formed in interstellar space. Thank you.